President Novus, you have a unique position of living precisely on the border of the EU and Russia, and the Baltic states have the unique experience of having been a part of the Soviet Union. And that makes you an observer per force and par excellence of Moscow. Where do you see the political trajectory going in Russia, and how would you characterize the style of government that has developed there? Post-Bolshevik? Tsarist? Transitioning towards democracy?
Well, I would say we're not on the border of the EU and Russia. We are the EU. So that's where what our perspective consists of is actually a firmly European view of things. Well, clearly the direction that our neighbor has taken when it comes to respect for freedom of speech and human rights is a step back from what I think everyone hoped. The term that has been invented to describe this originally was managed democracy, but that was kind of a PR failure, so now it's sovereign democracy. In general, when I hear qualifying, or when I see, but when you have adjectives put in front of the word democracy, then you have to watch out. I mean, they're people's democracies. We know what those were. Sovereign democracy, as opposed to democracy, again, is something which concerns us. And from our perspective, it's very difficult to tell where things are going. Clearly, the error that many of us made, I mean, I include myself among them, but I think it was something that we all fell for, was the identification of communism, strictly communism, with lack of human rights and free markets with freedom of speech. We should have thought back to the 30s. We should have looked at what was going on in Germany and in Italy, where you had capitalism, but you didn't have human rights and freedom of speech. We of course couldn't foresee that things would go in that direction, that we would have sort of unreined capitalism and a stifling of political opinion, of alternative views. I think that's the big question that we face today, you know, how we deal with it, because too many people, I think, have in the West have said, oh, well, I mean, there's capitalism, so what else is there? I mean, let's do business. And that kind of thinking we see perhaps too much of in the West, that the fundamental values were that united us in the Cold War don't seem to be so strong in the West as we thought, because in fact you see calls to ignore lack of human rights, the stifling of freedom of speech in order to make a dollar or to make a euro.
Mm-hmm. At the risk of making your response sound too harsh and too categorical, would you say that the West has essentially abandoned then the Russian human rights struggle within Russia simply because of this appearance of normalcy that's come with capitalism and an open market?
Well, I think that we in the West would not say yes, but I think if you talk to the people in the human rights movement in Russia and Memorial or the journalists under severe pressure today, in Russia itself, they're the ones who actually say that, I think, the most, and point the finger of blame for hypocrisy on the part of the West for not paying attention to what's going on. Well, And let's be honest, the Cold War forced us to have a certain amount of backbone, moral rigor, that was unacceptable to, with a very few exceptions, but it was really unacceptable to just try to make a buck when you were dealing with a totalitarian communist regime. And then, of course, it was not that easy to do it anyway because they were not—I mean, they were not capitalists. But I think that we have the sort of this spectrum of opinion on this is very broad. There are also national interest issues here that regarding energy that lead to some countries taking caring less about these issues, about human rights. There are personal interest issues, clearly, on the part of some people that we've seen. And, in fact, we end up with an odd situation in which the countries of the former communist countries that on the one hand, have the empirical, experiential knowledge of what it means to have lack of human rights, lack of freedom of speech. In some ways, are the, how to put this politely? Well, in any case, I would say that many of us feel that that talking about those very same issues is not popular, in fact, almost looked down upon by some of our colleagues in the European Union because those are viewed as somehow antiquated or out of place to talk about human rights and freedom of speech. And that's, I think that's a cause for concern, actually.
That's extremely interesting. And I think it's a triumph of economic interests, commercial interests, over the moral interests, as you've said. Let's jump down here to the question about the leaving human rights to what are essentially they're not even supranational organizations. They're simply coalitions of people who have good intentions, and the government has the governments of those countries have relied upon these organizations a great deal to press for human rights. I'm thinking of organizations like the OSCE. Looking back over the past decade and a half, has this approach been anywhere near adequate to advancing human rights within member states of such organizations, or does the very fact that these are coalitions of representatives of states inevitably seize up the works and make it really impossible to move ahead?
Well, any consensus-based organization, as the OSCE is, will lead to a common denominator, and the common denominator when it comes to democracy is fairly low. But since it is a consensus-based organization, that means it suffices only for one country to veto. Means that you can't go very far. The OSCE actually, specifically where the problems have come in is actually in a sub-organization. The OSCE is ODIHR, or the Office of Democracy and Human Rights, or whatever ODIHR is.
Right, I'll find the acronym.
But the organization that actually follows that monitors elections, that is what has turned out to be so unpopular in countries where democracy is not where it should be, or where democracy is something other than what we know it to be in the West. And we can see that very strong pressure on ODIHR to cease its actions, not to monitor elections, and threats to cut off funding to the OSCE if ODIHR continues to find that elections are not free and fair. And Well, what is the alternative? There is not much, especially since the other main organization that actually monitored human rights consistently was the Council of Europe, which was a normative organization. It was as opposed to the OSCE, which was consensual. The Council of Europe was normative. It had its principles, and if you followed it, you were okay. If you didn't follow those principles, you were not. But that has succumbed to political expediency, I would say, especially in the last 6 or 7 years under the leadership that it had, which was that where, unfortunately, I think, you know, when you have people running an organization that have business interests in countries without democracy, it leads to, dubious decisions. So the Council of Europe has given up on its norms. And so we don't really have any organization that is all-inclusive, that includes these countries that have democracy problems where these can be discussed. And what we really only have is countries that are democratic, that worry perhaps sometimes about lack of democracy in countries that are not. But the organizations themselves that include everyone are stymied. President Havel wrote just yesterday in the Herald Tribune a piece on the same issue, that where are we? I mean, we have human rights organizations chaired or run by countries whose own record, by any standard, at least for an Estonian or a Czech, is rather dubious.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting to speak about these with you because you have a direct experience with exactly these kinds of regimes, and you're under no illusions. When you speak to your colleagues in the EU, what do you suggest to them might be a better way to proceed dealing with these regimes that you know well?
Well, first and foremost, to pay attention to what's going on, and that's not to sweep it under the carpet in the name of political expediency. And that's basically all I can really suggest.
Mm-hmm. Do you urge more bilateral approaches to these things?
Actually, I think it's better to do it. I'd much rather see a more of a unified approach on the part of the European Union, because by the tendency to have make bilateral deals, it's really sort of divide et impera. One country will get a better deal, another one will get a worse deal. In fact, it is not in the interest of any of the smaller countries in the European Union to see the renationalization the nationalization of foreign policy inside the European Union. It's in fact the small countries that would much prefer to have a common foreign policy, but one in which they have a voice in what it is.
Mm-hmm. If we have a moment, let's pass on to one of the most egregious events of recent months, and that is the Russian-Georgia War of August, which led to the Russian recognition of two breakaway regions of Georgia. How do you rate the NATO and the EU response in this test?
Well, I think the initial EU response was very good, which was that there was an agreement signed by both the president of Russia and the president of Georgia that had six major points. One of which was the withdrawal of Russian troops from the occupied territories. NATO recognized territories. And the decision taken by the European Council September 30th was that until the Russian troops leave, or until the agreement is fulfilled, that is to say, until the Russian troops leave, there will the EU will not engage in the development of or the deepening of ties with Russia. But a month and a half later, when nothing had changed, the agreement was not fulfilled, the EU decided that it would continue with this partnership and cooperation agreement. That, I thought, was kind of strange. And there was a considerable amount of pressure put upon us to not block that, even though the previous agreement 6 weeks earlier had been that, yes, we will freeze the development of relations until the agreement brokered by the EU would in fact would be met, and then 6 months later, 6 weeks later, it's, well, thank God, common sense has prevailed and we have done nothing. I mean, it's basically, it was a sign that, in fact, the European Union does not, it's an internal sign, but I think very, well, the sign to its own member states is that what we agreed upon before doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Would you again cite the Georgia war with Russia as a kind of warning to the West that it really has to open its eyes
Well, I think what it is minimally, and what I've written a number of times, is that the war in Georgia was the first time after actually after the agreement in 1975 in Helsinki that international borders are not changed by force, that the fundamental assumptions of the last 35, 40 years, but especially since the collapse of communism, that Europe is not going to have wars, that no one is going to invade anybody, that fundamental assumption proved to be false. That fundamental assumption that we will not see military changes of borders, that we will not see a military aggression in Europe, those were the fundamental assumptions that, in fact, underlined the entire development of European security since 1989-1991. The way NATO developed, the way the European Union developed, if you recall, the main discussion in NATO 10 years ago was out of area or out of business, meaning that, well, there's no reason to maintain a NATO in Europe because, after all, no one's a threat, and there is going to be no war in Europe, no one's going to be invaded. That's why we have to worry about doing things outside the NATO, primary NATO area. Well, in fact, that assumption turned out to be false, and we need a rethink on what it is that it all means. And let's be honest, there's strong objection to that on the part of some NATO members, because they really would prefer not to deal with the issues facing Europe. They would like things, though, I mean, some of those NATO members don't get involved either in Afghanistan, nor do they want to see anything in Europe. So it leads me to think, well, I mean, what is NATO then?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask one last question in an effort to try to summarize some of these very many points that we've covered and some very interesting insights that you've given. What is the cost of not paying attention sufficiently to the internal situation in Russia or responding vigorously to challenges such as Moscow delivered to Tbilisi? Is the cost that we are not supporting the forces for change within Russia, and we're not developing any way to move out of the current status quo that Russian politics has fallen into?
Well, I really don't think we should be dealing with changing what Russia is doing. I think that I think that's a canard that is often imputed to us in the sort of the countries like mine, that we want to. We have no desire to change Russia ourselves. I think we want to make sure that Europe is immune from the pernicious, corruptive behaviors that we see elsewhere, because we don't want it in the European Union. When we see the selective application of EU laws so that you can fine Microsoft for antitrust action, but no action is taken against the even more egregious antitrust actions of common ownership of both distribution networks of and supply of gas. Clearly, those are the biggest violations of antitrust violations there are at all in Europe, is that, where yet the European Commission is not addressing that issue, but goes around fining Microsoft and Intel. All in areas where you actually have a complete freedom of choice. Do you want Microsoft? I use a Mac. I mean, you don't have to worry about it. Whereas on very clear, major, monopolistic solutions, the European Union gives Gazprom a free ride. In fact, wants to, I mean, people pushing for EU funding of issues of, I mean, of a state-owned company that clearly has been used as a foreign policy tool against Ukraine, for example, that has been used as a foreign policy tool against, where state energy companies are used against even the Czech Republic in terms of the Druzhba pipeline. I mean, these are areas where the inability of the European Union to, first of all, have a common position, but more importantly, apply its own laws, undermines the rule of law in the EU.
This is the greatest danger, then?
Well, I mean, this way, I don't... first and foremost, our own home must be secure. Before we start worrying about what's going on among our neighbors, we have to make sure our own home is secure. And if the foundations of our own home are being undermined, then we need to deal with that. So it may sound technical and specific, but frankly, I'm concerned that first and foremost, rule of law, democracy, stays firm and strong in Europe before we start worrying about telling others how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Fine. I think that's very, very interesting place to end. And unless you have some additional points that you would like to mention.
Well, I would say that I am here for the opening of the radio new RFERL building, and as someone who worked here for 9 years, during the most exciting period, I think, in the history of RFERL, which was from 1984 to 1993, that it's great to be back here, and I find that what the radio does remains highly important, especially if you look at the Freedom House report on press freedom that appeared last week. Or 2 weeks ago, where you get a fairly depressing picture that maybe that the job of the radios is not complete, and that our work in the 80s and well throughout that period was not as the outcome was not as wonderful as you would like to think, since of the 28 countries of the post-communist post-Soviet space, 8 have completely free media today. I'm very proud that Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania and Poland, the Czech Republic, there are countries with completely free media, and Estonia is the most free media of the in that rating, at least, of all of the post-communist countries. But that means there are 20 countries that do not have a free media of the target area of the radios in the 1980s. And if you look at the numbers, it's only 18% of the people that were in the broadcast area during my time, because at that time we didn't have. there was no broadcasting to Iran, for example. But of the countries that were broadcasting, only 18% of those of that entire population actually has a free medium. I mean, 82% of the people that we were broadcasting to in 1988, 86, 89, today remain in an unfree press environment, and that's depressing.
That is depressing. That's kind of shocking, really. So it also makes us think that winning the economic battle of the Cold War was a lot easier than winning the battle to change the political systems in these countries. And
that's what I said. I mean, you can have an authoritarian capitalist regime. It's not
exactly. So it's ironically, it's almost more difficult now to change these systems than it was the other, where the
What I'm going to mention in my speech today is about the sort of the seepage back in. Is that when you see the use of the court system in the UK to stifle dissent? I mean, one case which The Economist wrote about in this January about how an oligarch in Ukraine use the UK court systems to silence a Ukrainian newspaper writing in Ukraine in Ukrainian, but the fact that you can, in the UK system right now, allows court judgments to be rendered against small little newspapers in Eastern Europe or in places like Ukraine, stifle to stifle the free press. Mm-hmm. Because basically, even if the small Ukrainian newspaper would be right, I mean, if someone has the money to hire the best and most expensive libel lawyers in the UK, and whose hourly rates probably amounts to your annual profit, it's kind of difficult to fight against that.
Well, you're warning against the pernicious creeping of this Eastern political culture into the West.
Well, using our own system to abusing the openness of the West and the recourse to the courts that we have in the West and to advance their own ends.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, I listened with interest to your speech, and I think we're getting. No, we're not, actually. I thought that was Julian. I'm sorry, out of the corner of my eye.
Well, we're done. I need to have a cup of coffee before we go speak.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That was very interesting.